And those trombones can only mean one thing. It's Iris' birthday time. And on this February 27th, we're celebrating two birthdays, Lois Davis of Gilmore City and Brianna Gowan of Pella. So a very happy birthday to both Lois and Brianna on this February 27th. You're listening to IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service. If you're hearing us on your television, the Iowa PBS, and you're not a registered IRIS user, please give us a call at 515-243-6833 so we can get you on our list. We need to know who is listening in order to keep our services free. And now Deanna has today's obituaries.
Thank you, Pat. There's a wonderful quote here on this page that I want to share with you. This is from Sharon Alder. It says, "Inspirational quotes are dances of light that shine in dark places during your life." That's nice. The first obit is about James Chemis of Ankeny, age 72, who passed away on February 25th. Jim is survived by his wife, Mary, daughter, Anna, married to Adam Douglas, son, Jason, married to Julia Chemis, granddaughters Scarlett, Sloan, Olivia, and Rowan Douglas. Visitation will be held from 4 to 5:30 on Wednesday, February 28th, at Memorial Services of Iowa, 4208 North Ankeny Boulevard, with a prayer service at 5:30 p.m. A memorial service will be held at 10:30 in the morning on Thursday, the 29th, at Our Lady's Immaculate Heart Catholic Church, 510 East 1st Street in Ankeny. Richard Andrews, known as Andy, age 97, of Des Moines, passed away February 23rd at Mercy Medical Center. Richard, or Andy, was born January 6, 1927, to Martin and Hazel Andrews in Des Moines. A lifelong resident of the Des Moines area, Andy retired from the Polk County Health Department as a communicable disease investigator. He had a long career working with the city of Des Moines and the state, also in that same capacity. In his spare time, Andy enjoyed golfing and was the drum major with the Shrine Bagpipe Band. He was also a licensed private airplane pilot. Andy is survived by his wife of 78 years, Maxine Andrews, his son Kenneth, married to Barbara Andrews, daughter-in-law Teresa Andrews, many grand and great-grandchildren, and his sister, Beverly, married to Charles Packard. He was preceded in death by his son, Randall Andrews, his granddaughter, Stephanie Hart, and sister, Betty Jane Moore. Visitation will be held from 11:30 to 1 p.m. on Thursday, February 29th, at Hamilton's on Westtown Parkway in West Des Moines, with funeral services at 1:30 p.m. Burial will follow at Highland Memory Gardens. Steve Webb, age 67, of Des Moines, passed away on February 22nd at Iowa Methodist Medical Center. Steve was born January 2nd, 1957, in Des Moines, the son of Patricia Quick Walsh and the grandson of Raymond and Betty Webb. Steve was self-employed and ran his own garage door, lawn care, and snow removal businesses. He also served in the Navy. He was the hardest working man anyone could ever have met, working from sunrise to sunset during the seasons. Steve enjoyed catfishing and four-wheeling with his son and was an exceptional ping-pong player. Steve is survived by his son, Jeremy, married to Deborah Webb of Des Moines, his daughter, Anissa Brown of Des Moines, his mother, Patricia Walsh of Ankeny, his brother, Mike of Ankeny, Iowa, his brother, David, married to Mary Ann Webb of Des Moines, his brother, Dan Fogarty, married to Sherry of Bondurant, his brother, Tim Fogarty of Davenport, and his grandchildren, Jasleen Webb, Dylan, Nathan, Hannah, and Xander. Steve was preceded in death by his grandparents, Raymond and Betty Webb, Walter Quick, and Helen Quick. Services will be held at 10 a.m. Thursday, the 29th, at Hamilton's Funeral Home, 605 Lyon Street in Des Moines, with burial to follow at the Pine Hill Cemetery in Des Moines. The family will greet friends from 9 to 10 a.m. on Thursday morning at the funeral home prior to the service. Memorial contributions may be directed to NAMI, in loving memory of Steve. Sharon Garrington of Urbandale passed from this life on February 23rd. Sharon leaves to cherish her memory, her stepmother, Goldie Asmus of Osceola, her son, Todd Garrington of Waukee, and his wife, Shelley, grandsons, Tanner Garrington, Trey Garrington, Tate, Adam, and Matthew Garrington, brother Robert Asmus of Osceola, married to Peggy, and brother-in-laws, John, married to Linda, Beryl Kiner, David Mann, George, married to Debbie Garrington, sister-in-law Vicki Asmus, as well as other relatives and friends. Funeral services will be held at KL Funeral Home in Osceola, Wednesday, February 28th at 11 o'clock in the morning, with Pastor Matthew Sanford officiating. The family will greet friends for a viewing at 10 a.m. prior to services at the funeral home. Interment will be in the Sheraton Cemetery following the funeral. Pat, back to you.
Thank you, Deanna. Now back to more national and world news. Navalny Associates says swap is in the final stages. This is a story by the Associated Press. Associates of Russia opposition leader Alexei Navalny said Monday that talks were underway shortly before his death to exchange him for a Russian imprisoned in Germany. Alexei Navalny could have been sitting here now, today. It's not a figure of speech, Maria Pevich, who lives outside Russia, said in a video statement. She said she received confirmation the talks were in the final stages on February 15th, the day before Navalny was reported dead. Her claims could not be independently confirmed, and she did not offer any evidence to back them up. According to Pevich, Navalny and two U.S. citizens held in Russia were supposed to be swapped for Vadim Kruskov. He was serving a life sentence in Germany for the 2019 killing in Berlin of Zalamika Torki Kagaskovili, a 40-year-old Georgian citizen of Chechen descent. German judge said that Kovesko acted on the orders of Russian authorities, who gave him a false identity, passport, and resources to carry out the killing. She did not identify the U.S. citizens who were supposedly part of the deal. There are several in custody in Russia, including Wall Street Journal reporter Evan Gershkovich, who was arrested on espionage charges, and Paul Wayland, a corporate security executive from Michigan, convicted of espionage and serving a long prison sentence. They and the U.S. government dispute the charges against them. German officials have refused to comment when asked if there had been any effort by Russia to secure a swap of Kruskov. U.S. commentator Tucker Carlson earlier this month asked President Vladimir Putin about the prospects of exchanging Gershkovich, and Putin said the Kremlin was open to negotiations. He pointed to a man imprisoned in a U.S. allied country for liquidating a bandit who had allegedly killed Russian soldiers during separatist fighting in Chechnya. Putin didn't mention names but appeared to refer to Kruskov. Peskovich alleged in her video, without offering evidence, that Putin wouldn't tolerate setting Navalny free and decided to get rid of the bargaining chip. Asked at a regular news conference in Berlin about the claim by Navalny team, German government spokesman Christian Hoffmann said she couldn't comment. Navalny, age 47, Russia's best-known opposition politician, died February 16th in an Arctic penal colony while serving a 19-year sentence on extremism charges that he rejected as politically motivated. His family spent a week fighting with the authorities, who reportedly insisted on a secret funeral before his body was returned to them. Prominent Russians released videos calling on authorities to release the body. Western nations have hit Russia with more sanctions in response to Navalny's death, as well as for the invasion of Ukraine, which marked its second anniversary on Saturday. Navalny spokeswoman Kira Yarmish said Monday they were looking for a venue for a memorial service later this week. Deanna.
Thank you, Pat. On page 5 of the main section, Palestinian Prime Minister and his cabinet both resign. Focus in Gaza is shifting to possible reform after the war. This is from Christopher Kahn of USA Today. Palestinian Prime Minister Mohammed Shteya and his government resigned on Monday, signaling a potential willingness for reforms sought by the U.S. to revitalize governance in post-war Gaza. Palestinian President Mohammed Abbas must still decide whether to accept Shteya's and his cabinet's resignation. The Palestinian Authority was ousted from Gaza in a Hamas coup in 2007, but still has administrative control over some parts of the West Bank. Shtaya has served as prime minister since 2019. The next stage and its challenges require new governmental and political arrangements that take into account the new reality in the Gaza Strip, Shtaya said at a cabinet meeting in Ramallah in the West Bank. Abbas is expected to choose Mohammed Mustafa, chairman of the Palestinian Investment Fund, as the next prime minister. After U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken met with Abbas late last year, he told reporters they discussed reforms to combat corruption, empower civil society, and support a free press. Israel, meanwhile, is getting closer to expanding its ground offensive against Hamas to Rafah on the Gaza-Egypt border, where more than half the besieged territory's population of 2.3 million has sought refuge. The Israel military has presented the war cabinet with its double plan to evacuate Rafah, as well as details of its imminent invasion to dismantle what Israeli leaders have called Hamas's final stronghold, authorities said Monday. Though Netanyahu's office announced the developments, details of the plan have not been released, and it's unclear whether it was approved by the war cabinet. The long-awaited plan has been a concern of humanitarian aid groups, the United Nations, and the Biden administration, which said on Sunday that it had not yet seen a plan for Rafah that it would support. Leaders of multiple countries continued negotiating a deal that would include a pause in the fighting and release of many of the over 100 hostages still held in Gaza. Yoav Gallant, Israel's defense minister, said only after all the hostages are released will the hundreds of thousands of displaced Palestinians in Gaza be able to return to their homes in the north. Netanyahu has said any ceasefire deal would only delay Israel's evacuation and invasion of Rafah. If no agreement is reached, Israeli leaders said an invasion would begin on March 10th, the first day of the Muslim holy month of Ramadan. The statement from Netanyahu's office added that the war cabinet approved a plan for providing humanitarian assistance to the Gaza Strip in a manner that will prevent the looting that has occurred in the northern strip. Since last week, the World Food Program has suspended aid deliveries to northern Gaza, citing violence and chaos due to the collapse of civil order. The Palestinian Red Crescent Society, an independent aid group, announced Monday that it would suspend coordinating medical missions throughout the Gaza Strip for at least 48 hours, saying Israeli forces have on multiple occasions detained medical personnel and delayed urgent transports of patients. In a statement, the group called for the international community to compel Israel to, quote, respect and protect medical personnel and facilities and to provide a safe humanitarian space that is essential for the survival of Palestinians in Gaza, unquote. The Jordanian armed forces on Monday carried out 4 airdrops of aid for civilians in Gaza, according to Al Malaka TV, a Jordanian public news channel. The Hamas-run Gaza Health Ministry said Monday morning that in the previous 24 hours, 90 Palestinians were killed and 164 were injured across the territory. Since the war began, more than 29,700 Palestinians have been killed. The health ministry does not differentiate between civilian and combatant deaths, though it says most of the deceased are women and children. In Khan Yunis, a city in southern Gaza where the military had focused its offensive for weeks, an Israel fighter jet struck a Hamas compound. Israeli fighter jets on Monday also struck what the military said were Hezbollah targets deep inside Lebanon, the latest escalation in fighting since cross-border exchanges became nearly daily occurrences after October 7th. The Israeli military said in a post on X that the strikes near Hezbollah's stronghold of Baalbek were in response to a missile fired at Israel from Lebanon. The Israeli strikes were the most significant escalation in fighting since Saleh al-Ari, a top Hamas leader, was killed in January when an apparent Israeli strike hit a Beirut suburb. Hezbollah has said it will not stop its attacks on Israel until there's a ceasefire in Gaza. Human Rights Watch and Amnesty International on Monday accused Israel of failing to comply with an order by the UN's top court to provide humanitarian aid to the more than 2 million people in Gaza. The International Court of Justice, based in The Hague, in the Netherlands, in January, ordered Israel to take measures to limit death and destruction in Gaza as part of a case brought by South Africa, alleging that Israel's military action in its war with Hamas amounts to genocide. Human Rights Watch said the number of aid trucks that have entered the Gaza Strip in recent weeks has dropped 30%, and that Israel has not facilitated fuel deliveries to areas in the Northern Territory. Israeli leaders have denied restricting aid and instead have blamed humanitarian organizations, saying hundreds of trucks filled with aid sit idle on the Palestinian side of the main crossing. The UN says it can't always reach the trucks at the crossing because it is too dangerous. On Monday, the UN's top court, was scheduled to hear final arguments in a series of hearings on Israel's occupation of the West Bank and Gaza. An opinion from the court on the long-debated issue is not expected for several weeks. Pat.
Thank you, Deanna. Continuing with National and World News on page 8A of the Des Moines Register. Court declines case on ticket for honking. Woman argued the honks were protected speech. This is a story written by Maureen Groppi of USA Today. Don't honk if you agree. The Supreme Court on Monday upheld a California traffic law that bans honking other than to warn another driver, turning down a challenge to the law from a woman ticketed for honking while driving by a rally outside her congressman's office in 2017. Susan Porter had argued her beeps of support were protected by the First Amendment. Her lawyers wrote in their appeal, "The car horn is the sound of democracy in action." But the court didn't bite. The justices declined, without comment, to review California's law. Though they appear to be rarely enforced, similar laws are on the books in 41 states, according to court records. A New York law bars drivers from sounding a car horn for anything other than, quote, a reasonable warning, unquote. Missouri admonishes drivers to use their horns for warning purposes only. The Supreme Court is generally reluctant to question the constitutionality of laws that virtually every state has enacted, California's lawyers argued. Porter's attorneys had said such requirements defy reality. During the pandemic, to avoid bringing large crowds together for a traditional campaign rally, then-presidential candidate Joe Biden organized drive-in rallies in which he encouraged people to honk if you want to be united again. In 2020, a convoy of truckers honked their horns outside the White House in protest as former President Donald Trump was delivering remarks in the Rose Garden. But a three-judge panel of the San Francisco-based U.S. Court of Appeals for the Ninth Circuit agreed with California that too much honking makes the horn less effective as a warning device to other drivers and pedestrians. In fact, it can be distracting, the majority said. One of the three judges dissented, saying she would have allowed political protest honking. The two others said it would be too difficult, if not impossible, for officers to enforce the law only when there's proof that honking has distracted other drivers or disturbed the peace. U.S. Circuit Court Judge Michelle Friedland wrote for the appeals court, "To be sure, most non-warning honks do not create distractions resulting in accidents. But we discern no plausible means by which California could permit non-distracting honks while prohibiting distracting honks. The law is different from noise ordinances adopted in many local communities. Those usually involve time or place restrictions barring drivers from leaning on their horns in a residential neighborhood, for instance, or in the evening. The California law Porter was ticketed for violating is categorical, meaning it applies at all times and places. It carries a fine of $238. In Porter's case, her ticket was dismissed when the sheriff's deputy failed to attend the traffic court hearing. She'd been pulled over, according to the state, after honking her horn 11 to 15 times in a row in support of protests outside the district office of U.S. Representative Daryl Issa, a Republican from California. the Supreme Court has repeatedly ruled that speech protected by the First Amendment encompasses more than the spoken word. In a landmark 1969 decision, for example, a 7-2 majority of the justices ruled that students wearing black armbands to protest the Vietnam War were taking part in protected speech. 7 years later, the court said that campaign contributions are a form of political speech. Deanna?
Thank you, Pat. Okay, I'm going to read news analysis here by Susan Page of the USA Today. Trump signals general election strategy. The plan is to sound alarm on Biden and stick to the script. After Donald Trump routed Nikki Haley in the season's first primary in New Hampshire, he spent his victory speech ridiculing everything from her ethics to her apparel. But after an even bigger victory in the South Carolina primary Saturday, he didn't even mention her name. Welcome to the next phase of the presidential race. Haley insists she's not ready to abandon the GOP field to Trump, and she has the campaign cash necessary to stay in at least through Super Tuesday on March 5th. Then, contests in 15 states and one territory will award a third of the delegates to the Republican National Convention in July. But after a 20 percentage point thumping in her home state, there is no longer a realistic path for the former South Carolina governor to deny Trump the nomination. The primary ends tonight, the Trump campaign declared Saturday in a written statement, and it's time to turn to the general election so we can defeat Crooked Joe. It's an approach Trump has embraced. On Saturday, in his victory speech and in earlier remarks to the Conservative Political Action Conference in Washington, he mostly focused his fire on President Joe Biden. The pair of speeches Saturday signaled a pivot for Trump and provided clues to the strategy he plans to follow in the general election as he makes his third bid for the White House. Number one, it's his party, all of it. I've never seen the Republican Party so unified as it is right now, Trump declared with satisfaction on Saturday. Though he faced a dozen credible challengers when the 2024 campaign began, Trump has triumphed in the four opening states in Iowa, New Hampshire, Nevada, and now South Carolina. Exit polls in South Carolina showed him winning among both men and women, among every age and income group. Nationwide, he can claim the support of almost every elected Republican who has made an endorsement. Ralph Norman of South Carolina is the only member of Congress from anywhere who has publicly supported Haley. In modern times, no contested nomination fight in either party has ever been settled with such dispatch. That said, the GOP isn't really one happy family, at least not yet. After all, 4 in 10 of those who showed up to vote in South Carolina cast ballots for his challenger. That is not some tiny group, said Haley. Number two, reach beyond the base. The solid support of Republicans is enough to win the nomination, but it's not enough to claim the presidency. That requires support from others, including swing voters, such as suburbanites and even some traditional Democrats. The Trump campaign even hopes to peel off some support among black voters, the most loyal demographic in the Democratic base. That's one reason he addressed the Black Conservative Federation Gala in Columbia Friday night. He was joined by prominent black Republicans who are supporting him, including former Housing and Urban Development Secretary Ben Carson and South Carolina Senator Tim Scott. But Trump's offhand comments sparked criticism from Haley, Democrats, and others for portraying his indictment on 91 felony charges as one reason black voters are drawn to him. He said, "A lot of people said that's why the black people liked me, because they had been hurt so badly and discriminated against." He said, adding that black Americans had embraced T-shirts that featured his mugshot taken in Georgia. Haley said the remarks were offensive, and Cedric Richmond, co-chair of Biden's re-election committee, called them insulting, moronic, and just plain racist. So far, Trump seems to be making little progress among black voters. In a nationwide USA Today Suffolk University poll released last month, Trump had the support of just 12% of black voters, precisely the percentage that he received in the 2020 election. In what some Republicans see as an opening, however, Biden's support was at 63%, down precipitously from 87% in 2020, as 1 in 5 black voters drifted to third-party candidates. Number three, portrayed Biden as the threat. Biden has depicted Trump as dangerous, a would-be despot who would dismantle the NATO alliance, deny women the right to make fundamental health decisions, and imperil democratic institutions. Trump tells voters that the southern border was more secure, the economy stronger, and crime lower when he was president. Some of those assertions are untrue. Since Biden became president, the U.S. murder rate has declined and the unemployment rate has hit record lows, although inflation has risen. At CPAC, Trump warned suburban women that they could be threatened by gangs of undocumented immigrants invading your territory if Biden were reelected. "A vote for Trump is your ticket back to freedom," Trump said, his language dark. "It's your passport out of tyranny, and it's your only escape from Joe Biden's fast track to hell." Then he tried to turn Biden's most ominous warning back on him, a sort of "I'm not, you are" taunt. Pat.
Thank you, Dan. And our final story from the Des Moines Register today, Haley's campaign loses big source of funding. This is a story from USA Today writer Carissa Waddick. Americans for Prosperity Action, the conservative grassroots organization founded by billionaire Charles Koch, is ceasing all spending in support of Nikki Haley's 2024 presidential campaign. The group's CEO, Emily Seidel, told staff in a Sunday email obtained by USA Today that its political arm, AFP Action, was refocusing its spending efforts in House and Senate races in light of Haley's double-digit loss to former President Donald Trump in the South Carolina primary. Seidel wrote, "Nikki Haley has shown us again and again that we made the right decision supporting her candidacy. But given the challenges in the primary states ahead, we don't believe any outside group can make a material difference to widen her path to victory. And so while we will continue to endorse her, we'll focus our resources where we can make the difference." The move was first reported by Politico. It's the latest sign that Haley's bid for the 2024 GOP nomination is ailing. She has lost every state so far in the race, including contests in Iowa, New Hampshire, and South Carolina. Despite the defeats, Haley has said that she will remain in the race at least until Super Tuesday on March 5th, when voters in 15 states and one territory head to the polls. The Haley Aligned Super PAC, SFA Fund Incorporated, confirmed on Sunday that it is still spending in support of Haley, including a $500,000 ad buy in Michigan ahead of today's primary in that state. "Nikki Haley is the new generational leader and the only candidate in the race who can bring Americans together and defeat Joe Biden," the group's spokesperson, Priya Samsundar, said in a statement. SFA Fund Incorporated will continue its efforts to support Nikki Haley's efforts to win the nomination. Haley's campaign amassed more than $1 million in grassroots donations in less than 24 hours after the South Carolina primary. Her campaign spokesperson, Olivia Perez Cubas, called AFP a great organization, ally in the fight for freedom and conservative government, and thanked them for their support in a statement. Well, for the last 90 minutes, your readers have been Deanna Snyder and Pat Steele. It's been our pleasure to read for you. Now, we'll take a short break to allow our next readers, Dale and Doug, to get into place.
Welcome back. Your new readers are Dale Finnegan and Doug Kretzinger. We'll continue with articles from the Des Moines Register and USA Today. And now here is Doug with our first article.
Thank you very much, Dale. Opinion number one, USA Today. Haley says it's her duty to keep on fighting. It's written by Ingrid Jocks, and she is a columnist at USA Today. And it reads, Troy, Michigan. Just a day after a sizable loss in her home state of South Carolina, Nikki Haley made her case on Sunday to Michigan ahead of this state's Republican presidential primary on Tuesday. Haley's not giving up. Despite losing every primary contest thus far to former President Donald Trump, the former South Carolina governor and U.S. ambassador to the United Nations has chosen to continue standing for the significant number of Americans who aren't satisfied with the current frontrunners. In South Carolina, she garnered roughly 40% of the vote, as she did in New Hampshire. In an interview with me ahead of her Sunday evening rally, Haley said she is the Republican Party's best hope to beat President Joe Biden in November, and that's her number one goal. It's a warning sign that Donald Trump can't win an election. Quote, I'm continuing this fight because 70% of Americans don't want to see Donald Trump or Joe Biden. If you look at the early states, 40% of Republican voters have rejected Donald Trump. If you're the Republican technical incumbent, that doesn't bode well for the Republican Party. And so long as there is this group of Americans that are saying we want better, I feel a duty to keep on fighting. I feel a duty to keep on showing a voice, end quote, she said. As with the earlier primary states, Trump holds a dominant lead in Michigan over Haley by about 50 points. But Haley isn't letting the polls slow her down. And she said she'll stay at least through Super Tuesday on March 5 when 16 states and one territory vote. Her ability to keep campaigning hinges on how much money she has. Haley has kept posting strong fundraising numbers, which points to the dissatisfaction among many voters. She was dealt a blow Sunday, however, when Americans for Prosperity Action, the conservative powerhouse associated with billionaire Charles Koch, announced it would end its financial support of Haley's campaign after Saturday's loss in South Carolina. Given what all the polls show about dissatisfaction with Trump and Biden, it's jarring the country is likely to again face that voice choice in November, one so many people say they don't want. Haley, 52, said both Republicans and Democrats need to wake up and think hard about what they're doing with Trump, 77, and Biden, 81. Quote, I think it's interesting that we've got a country in disarray, a world on fire, and we think we're going to go forward with two 80-year-olds, she said. She went on. It defies logic when you need someone who's got to serve 8 years, day and night, no drama, no vendettas, just results for the American people. We got to think about that, right? End quote. Haley said she is the best alternative for Americans who say they want another choice, and she said the amount of support she's receiving should be a warning for the Republican Party. Quote, it's a warning sign that Donald Trump can't win an election. It's a warning sign when you let one man turn the Republican Party into his own personal playpen, end quote. I asked Haley what she plans to do if Republicans aren't smart enough to choose her as their candidate. Shouldn't voters who won't support Trump or Biden still have a choice? Speculation has been rampant that she could join forces with a group like No Labels for a third-party run. Haley's not ready to talk about that, however, and she's committed to her party. I'm a Republican, she said. At this point, I don't know how you translate that over. The reason people are gravitating towards me is because the tone at the top matters and how you talk about issues matters. People don't want to be hating each other. They don't want under this tent of anger anymore. They don't want the division, she said. She went on, and so I'm trying to bring it to where we can have an America that doesn't have that. But that's through the Republican Party that I do this. so we'll have to wait and see, she said. Haley also said that serving as Trump's vice president is out of the question for her. Quote, I'm not doing this to be VP. I'm doing this to be a third-party candidate. I'm not doing this for my political career. I'm doing it truly out of a love of America. And because I'm worried about my kids and everybody else's kids, we're better than the country we are seeing right now with the division that we have. Dale?
The second opinion from the USA Today is written by Joseph Givargese. And I apologize if I'm mispronouncing that. It's Geevargese. He is the executive director of Our Revolution, the largest grassroots progressive political action group in the country. And Mr. Givargese, his column is titled, If President Biden Abandons Gaza, Don't Count on Our Votes. And here's what he has to say. President Joe Biden's decision to unilaterally veto yet another United Nations ceasefire resolution on Gaza, just a week before Michigan's Democratic presidential primary Tuesday, shows just how out of touch the president's reelection campaign is with the progressive voters who put him in power. Nearly 30,000 civilians have been killed in Gaza, mostly women and children. And yet the Biden administration continues to break with the majority of the Democratic base to align with and fund Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's right-wing government. Is this worth risking Donald Trump's return to the White House and the end of American democracy? Biden now trails Trump in 7 of the past 8 polls in the pivotal swing state of Michigan, by as many as 10 points in the recent CNN poll. The Biden team desperately needs a wake-up call. That's why Our Revolution is mobilizing tens of thousands of progressives to vote uncommitted in Tuesday's Democratic primary to make sure Michigan is a megaphone for peace. The initiative, kicked off by Listen to Michigan, is a strategic effort to send a clear message to the Biden campaign. Change course now on Gaza or risk alienating key voter blocks needed to defeat Trump in November. This is Biden's chance to begin stitching back together the coalition that won him the White House in 2020 by realigning his policies with the values of the base, especially young voters and voters of color. Not only does Michigan have the largest Arab American population in the country, it's also a historic battleground state where the margin of victory swung from fewer than 11,000 votes for Trump in 2016 to just more than 154,000 votes for Biden in 2020. If Biden doesn't recalibrate his foreign policy, 2024 could look less like 2020 and more like 2016, when Arab Americans and Muslim Americans rejected Hillary Clinton in part because of her record in the Middle East as Secretary of State. Now, in 2024, many are feeling a sense of betrayal by Biden, who promised to end endless wars and lead with empathy. Our Revolution is joining this critical effort to ensure the Democratic Party does not lose the support of its progressive voting base and, in turn, surrender Michigan to Republican control and send Trump back to the Oval Office. As the country's largest grassroots progressive political action group, Our Revolution is urging our 87,000 supporters in Michigan to vote uncommitted in hopes of getting the Biden administration to alter its approach to the Israel-Hamas war. Representative Rashida Tlaib, a Democrat from Michigan, and former Representative Andy Levin, Democrat from Michigan, both are supporting this effort, indicating the collective push from within the party to correct course, save lives, and not lose to Trump. There are voters who, having lost family members in Gaza, may never vote to reelect President Biden. But, as Levin wrote in an email to Our Revolution's members, there are many others who would be willing to come back to Biden if we can get him to come around on Gaza. To be clear, this is more than just a protest vote, more than mere political strategy. President Biden has a moral imperative to cease U.S. involvement in the bloodshed of innocents. However, if the moral case and massive protests are not compelling enough, we must appeal to Biden's fundamental self-interest, re-election. Failure to change course on Gaza will stain the Democratic Party for generations, and 4 more years of Trump will forever alter the course of the nation. This moment calls for unity and action among progressive voters, the key to Democrats' success in the 2024 election and beyond. The carnage in Gaza needs to end. The president must be a peacemaker, and we must defeat Trump in November. It all starts with making progressive voices heard in the primaries in Michigan and beyond. And to President Biden, we urge you to realign with the base that brought you to the White House in the first place. Our future depends on it. Again, that opinion was from Joseph Givargis.
And it is time for sports on the Des Moines Register. Waukee girls hold off Ankeny Centennial 46-44 is one of the articles on the front page, written by Alyssa Hertel. And I'm going to read that now. Free throws win basketball games. That was the case in Monday's Class 5A State Tournament quarterfinal game between the Waukee and Ankeny Centennial girls. The number 4 seeded Warriors didn't score a single field goal in the fourth quarter and only 4 points total, but that was enough to beat the number 5 Jaguars 46-44 and advance to Thursday's semifinal against Johnston. Obviously, quote, obviously I was a little nervous as a coach, Waukee coach Danielle Franklin said, went on to say, but we've been in those moments when we haven't always been shooting the ball well. We've grown and had to work through those struggles, end quote. If the first 4 minutes of this matchup decided the winner, Centennial would have had it in the bag. The Jaguars went on a 10-0 run over 4 minutes and 22 seconds, aided in part by 5 steals during that span. Sophia Hope sank a 3-pointer to stop Centennial's streak. Jaden Pratt got one back for the Jaguars, and then Waukee scored 11 straight to take the lead before the end of the first quarter. What we've talked about throughout this whole season is that defense is what's going to pull us out of anything, Franklin said. She continued, defense is going to win games. I was proud of our crew for staying together defensively in those moments. We trusted them to defend. The back and forth continued in the second quarter, but Centennial struggled to get its shots to fall. Waukee shot 50% from the field and 54.5% from beyond the arc in the first half, compared to Centennial, which went 28% overall and 14.3% from three-point range. Centennial improved its shooting in the third quarter, but Waukee held the Jaguars at arm's length. 5 points separated the two teams after three quarters, and neither team scored for the first 3.5 minutes of the fourth. Centennial's Ava Martin ended the drought. Waukee made 4 of 6 free throws in the final quarter. 2 free throws gave Waukee a 1-point lead with 1:22 left to play. 1 more free throw extended that lead to 2, and Marnie Zalo grabbed the rebound for Waukee. The Warriors ran down the clock and missed their final shot. Mia Crawford's layup bounced off the rim in the final seconds, and Centennial was able to get another shot off before time expired. Centennial's Jaden Pratt scored a game-high 22 points. Crawford had 9 rebounds. 2 Hawkeye players stood out in the victory. Kirsten Hawk scored 10 points and had 5 rebounds and 3 assists. Sophia Hope tallied 9 points, 13 rebounds, and 2 blocks. Hope played with 4 fouls but managed to stay on the floor when her team needed her in the fourth quarter. That's a senior right there, Franklin said. Someone who is headstrong, knows exactly what she needs to do in every moment. To bounce back with foul trouble and continue to play hard is impressive.
I'll go ahead and read the other high school basketball story. This is girls' high school basketball. Number one, Johnston Coast to Victory versus West Des Moines Valley, also written by Alyssa Hartel. 8 minutes and 19 seconds. That's how long top-seeded Johnston girls basketball held Valley without a point from early in the third quarter through the beginning of the fourth on Monday. The Dragons went on a 14-0 run during that time to seal their 60-31 victory over the Tigers in a Class 5A state tournament quarterfinal. A lot of time we come out of halftime with a big lead, Johnston coach Chad Gillick said. Sometimes our girls will come out slow, and we always tell them we have to match the energy from the beginning of the game. We gave up two or three offensive rebounds, and I took a timeout to try and refocus. From that point on, they were pretty focused, end quote. Johnston was able to sub out its entire starting lineup before the midway point of the fourth quarter, but not before the Dragons' leading five made their mark. Jenica Lewis contributed a team-high 18 points and went 3 of 5 from three-point range in the win. Ailey Tanke was the only other Johnston starter to finish in double digits with 10 points, but Alea Riley and Amani Jenkins came close with 9 each. That's one of the things that makes Johnston such a difficult matchup. There might not be a team that boasts balanced scoring quite like the Dragons. Lewis led the team in scoring on Monday and in four other games this season. Tanke has been the leading scorer in 11 matchups. The rest of the starting lineup, Jenkins, Riley, and Jelaya Kinnitz, have led in at least two games this season. You saw what Valley was trying to do out there, Gillick said. They tried to face guard Ailey and Jenica, but both of them still had double digits. And it's been that way all year. It's a huge deal if you've got five girls that can score in double figures any time, and that's hard to take away, Gillick said. Outside of scoring, the Dragons did all the little things right. Johnston shot 48.9% from the field and 40% from beyond the arc. The defense challenged Valley and forced the Tigers to take tough shots. Valley shot 28.6% from the field and made less than a quarter of its attempts from behind the arc. The Tigers struggled to protect the ball, finishing with 21 turnovers and allowing Johnston to steal the ball 9 times. With the win, Johnston advances to the 5A state semifinal on Thursday at 10 a.m. The Dragons will face Waukee. Always good to get that first one out of the way, Gillick said. The girls came and took care of business today. We told them that if you match the energy of any team out there, there's not a lot of teams that can stay with you. I'm going to let you know what you can watch on television if you're interested in seeing some sports on TV tonight in men's college basketball at 6 p.m. on Peacock. You can watch Wisconsin at Indiana. Then at 8 p.m. on ACCN, Wake Forest will be at Notre Dame, and on BTN, Penn State will be at Iowa. So the Iowa game is tonight, men's basketball on BTN, Penn State at Iowa at 8 p.m. In women's college basketball, at 6 p.m. tonight, you can catch Indiana at Northwestern on BTN. And if you're interested in Major League Baseball, there is a spring training game that you can catch on MLBN at noon today. It will be Washington versus Houston, and they'll be playing in West Palm Beach, Florida. I'll do another short article here down below that. UNI wins last four bouts, defeats Wisconsin at home. This is written by Eli McCown. Northern Iowa Wrestling rolled to a dominant victory over Wisconsin on Sunday, winning 27-11 over the Badgers in the Panthers' final regular season duel of the season. The contest was tied at 11 after six bouts with 133-pounder Julian Farber, 141-pounder Cale Happel, and 157-pounder Ryder Downey each picking up wins, including a 22-6 technical fall for Happel over Felix Latini. From 174 pounds on, the Panthers dominated. Sophomore Jared Sima not only had an upset win over Max Mailer, He did so in dominant fashion with a 16-6 major decision. 184-pounder Parker Kekkonen rolled as well to an 11-3 major decision over Shane Ligel. He is now 23-0 heading into the postseason as the favorite to win a title in his class. From there, the Panthers also got two major decisions from Wyatt Volker and Tyrell Gordon to cap off the victory. Doug?
And before we get to Dear Abby, here's a football note. We've done basketball and wrestling. ISU football promotes from within for new offensive coordinator. And it's Iowa State's football new coordinator will be a familiar face, Taylor Mouser, M-O-U-S-E-R, who has been with Coach Matt Campbell since 2015 at Toledo and has served as the Cyclones tight ends coach since 2021, will be promoted to lead the Iowa State offense, according to a source with direct knowledge of the situation. Move comes after Nate Schielhaus departed the position after one season last week to become the passing game coordinator for the Los Angeles Rams of the NFL. So Mouser has guided a prolific tight ends group that has featured future NFL players Charlie Kolar, Chase Allen, and saw the emergence of Ben Bramer this past season as a potential future star. He also was given the title of assistant head coach prior to last season. Iowa State offense ranked 10th in scoring offense in the Big 12 last season, but showed marked improvement under Schielhaus, especially during conference play. The Cyclones also returning a promising core of young players led by quarterback Rocco Becht, the Big 12 offensive freshman of the year. Iowa State also returns leading rusher Abu Sama, as well as its top three receivers and wideouts, Jaden Higgins and Nalen Noel, alongside Bramer at tight end. And that's about it for the sports section for today. It's time to get into the Dear Abby article, and I'm going to read it to you now. It's titled, Man's Chronic Unemployment Creates Doubt for Couple's Future. It says, Dear Abby, I'm a 32-year-old woman who has been with my boyfriend, my first and only partner, for 11 years. Overall, our relationship is healthy. He's smart, he's kind, supportive, caring, loyal, and funny. I can see us getting married and living a happy life together. The problem is, aside from a few short-term gigs, he hasn't had a job for the last 6 years. When he left his office job to move with me for my career, I've done well, but although he has applied for all sorts of jobs, sales, admin, medical, police, government, fast food, no one has hired him. Last year, he developed a heart condition, and he can no longer perform physical labor. He also suffers from depression. So I've been paying for nearly everything. I'm lucky not to have credit card debt, but at age 32, I have no retirement savings. My job barely covers living expenses for us and our pets. I want to progress in life and have an equal partner. We've discussed marriage and think he's the one. But how long should I hold out hope of him finding a job? Do I just keep on hoping, or do I consider ending things and breaking both our hearts? Burdened in Florida, it is signed. Dear Abby says, Dear Burdened, has occurred to you that the reason the man you love has been unable to find employment all this time may be connected to his depression? It would benefit you both if he consulted a doctor and sought treatment for it. Free and low-cost counseling is available through the county, as well as through colleges and universities with departments of psychology. Please explore this before ending your relationship because it could be the solution to your problem. Here's another one. Dear Abby, my sister has become very interested in Zen meditation. I'm afraid she has become obsessed with it. She spent a week at a special meditation workshop during which she had said she meditated all day, every day, to the point that her back hurt from sitting so much. She's now saying she wants to become a Zen priest, which necessitates spending 3 months at a Zen center meditating constantly. My sister has a husband and two teenage daughters I think she's neglecting. She earned a master's degree in economics at a prestigious university but works only part-time as a bookkeeper to allow more time for her Zen center. How can I politely persuade her to focus on her family and career and let Zen meditation be her hobby rather than the focus of her life? Signed, Priorities in the West. Dear Priorities, your sister is an adult, intelligent and capable of making her own decision about the path in life she chooses. Nowhere did you state that her husband and children disagree with it. I do not think your input on this subject, regardless of how politely you offer it, will be welcomed. Keep your opinion to yourself unless asked for it.
I think we have time for one or two 50 States articles before I close here. From Missouri in Springfield. After weeks of speculation, State Senator Lincoln Huff announced he will run for Missouri Lieutenant Governor this year. And in Nebraska, from Lincoln, a lawmaker who supported banning abortions after 12 weeks has introduced legislation that provides exceptions and repeals criminal penalties. Republican Senator Merv Reapy's bill would allow for abortions up to 20 weeks in cases of fetal anomalies, with the confirmation by at least two physicians that a preborn child is incompatible with life outside the womb and would die upon birth or inevitably after that. And in Minnesota, from St. Cloud, longtime politician Tad Jude announced he is running for the 3rd congressional seat, becoming the 5th Republican vying for the nomination in a seemingly safe Democratic district. That brings us to the end of the Des Moines Register for today. I'm Dale Finnegan, and my partner at the microphone has been Doug Kretzinger. Earlier, you heard Deanna Snyder and Pat Steele. You can listen to IRIS programs on any computer or smart device at any time at our website, iowaradioreading.org. Support for today's readings come from the Des Moines Register, Iowa Public Radio, Iowa PBS, and bensoundmusic.com. Thank you for listening to IRIS, Iowa's first and only radio reading service.